Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
Are we living in a revolutionary moment? Fareed Zakaria makes the case that we are. And if he's right, there's a lot at stake.
I think the stakes are really liberal democracy. What has happened is the people who are displaced, anxious, angry, radicalized, the focus of their ire, their attention is basically to tear down the system, you know, the world that produced all this.
Hear more this week on The Gray Area, available wherever you get your podcasts.
My guests today are Don Moynihan and Pam Hurd. They are a husband and wife team of academics, co-authors of a great book on a sort of really fascinating subject. They call it administrative burdens. This is like, it's something we don't think about a lot in politics, but it makes a huge difference. It has to do with like how the exact design of programs impacts people's lives in a real way. It's an incredibly weedsy topic. And I think, you know, if you like this show, you are going to love this conversation. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. My guests today, we've got Pam Hurd and Don Moynihan. They are respectively a professor of public policy at the McCourt School at Georgetown University and the McCourt Chair and public policy professor at the McCourt School, also at Georgetown. Most importantly, co-authors of a book, Administrative Burden, Policymaking by Other Means. This is about a really interesting concept that I think, like, once you hear about it, you start seeing it everywhere. Let's just like start with the beginning. Like, what are administrative burdens?
Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining in. So a shorthand way of thinking about this is that there are the frictions we experience when we encounter government. And so partly it's the learning costs of finding out about a program, whether you're eligible for it, what you might get out of it. Partly it's the compliance costs of filling out a bunch of forms. Partly it's the psychological costs if you find the process stressful or stigmatizing in some way. And we think collectively that sort of colors then your perception of government and how you think about your experience with government.
And a really great recent example of this is in Tennessee, where about 220,000 children have lost access to Medicaid health insurance coverage, largely because of administrative burdens. So the absolute reduction in number of children on Medicaid is largest in Tennessee compared to any other state in the country over the past 2 years. And effectively, what goes on in Tennessee is if you're even already enrolled in Medicaid, you actually twice a year have to kind of re-verify that you're still eligible for the program. And this involves things like filling out a 50-page application that you have to send back. You have to get it. And a lot of people move around, so they don't get it because they've moved around. And then you have to fill out everything accurately. And if you don't, they don't call you and tell you or notify you by mail. They just drop your coverage. So there's all these examples of people showing up at the doctor or showing up for a surgery and realizing that their kids no longer have health insurance coverage. In one example, this woman was talking about her two sons, and she'd enrolled both kids. One kid got disenrolled because she had forgotten to provide just a Social Security card. Again, they never told her. She shows up at the doctor and realizes they don't have health insurance coverage. It takes her months and months and months because she has to actually walk through all these administrative processes to challenge the decision. She barely gets him back enrolled and realizes that the second child is now disenrolled because the state doesn't recognize that the kids were brothers, basically, in the same family. So it's those sorts of things that really, you can imagine there the kind of learning costs that people experience in terms of just realizing all this crap that they have to do, the compliance costs in terms of the amount of time and effort it takes to take care of it. And then when you're talking about programs like this, the psychological costs, like how damaging that is to people in terms of stress levels and actual health outcomes if you get kicked off really critical health insurance coverage.
And so this is like, you know, as journalists, right, people who write about policy, people who talk about policy, this is the kind of thing we can tend to sort of gloss over, right? You're describing a program, you're saying, well, it's a program for children who live here and their family has such and such an income. And then the question is like, well, okay, how do you establish that a given person is in fact a child, does live there, qualifies for the income? I mean, I even remember, it shouldn't have shocked me, but it was like when my son was getting ready to go to preschool here in the district, we had to enroll him. And we'd like heard a lot of hype about the lottery and getting, but like it was fine. There was plenty of space in the school. But it was then like actually getting him enrolled, you know, it's not automatic, right? And particularly because you're not a paying customer, right? If you go to a store and you're trying to buy something, it's in their interest to make it easy for you to go give them the money. And the government is not necessarily like that, right?
Well, and that's what's really interesting. Yeah. So any social welfare program, right, has exactly what you're saying, which is there's a defined set of people who should be receiving benefits. And there's all these criteria that you have to meet to make sure that you're getting people on the program that you want on the program. What's interesting, though, is that the degree to which that burden of kind of establishing that is borne by the state versus by individuals varies a lot by the program you're talking about. So the Social Security program, for example, is a lovely example. It's the easiest thing to enroll in Social Security. It'll take you about 5 minutes. But when you think about it, right, like if it were structured differently, what you might be required to do is provide 40 years of your earnings records, your citizenship evidence, evidence of marital status, actually, because a lot of people receive benefits based on marital status. So not just your evidence of marital status, but then you have to turn over your husband's earning records, for example. Mm-hmm. So, but we didn't structure the program that way. We structured it in a way that made the state bear the burdens versus programs like Medicaid and food stamps, which are similar in terms of, and arguably, actually, you might think it's even a little bit lower in terms of the kinds of things you need to know about someone. But the burden is just completely different. So, you know, you have 100% take up. Everyone who's eligible for Social Security draws on it. Programs like food stamps, Medicaid, anywhere, depending on the state, you're talking about 50 to 80% of people who are actually eligible get benefits.
And this is because Social Security Administration has your records.
They structured it that way.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
They designed the program. So, in the early 1930s, when they were implementing the program, there were debates about actually how to do it. And one version was like you collect stamps in a stamp booklet, and then you turn in your stamp booklet after 40 years. That was quickly, people thought that's not viable. It'll be too difficult to navigate fraud, blah, 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 blah. But it was an extraordinary administrative task to figure out actually how do you track the entire population of the U.S. and the earnings, right? Like that was extraordinarily effortful. And there are ways, even current social welfare programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit, for example, are inherently less burdensome than other kinds of programs like food stamps.
And we take Social Security for granted, the fact that it is easy to enroll in because we have Social Security numbers. But that was a design, right? That was a choice that was made at the time that wasn't obvious, that is still the closest thing we have to a national ID. And it was very controversial. If you look back at the history of the 1936 presidential debates, this issue came up quite a bit. So it is partly a matter of choices that are made at the design of the program. And so going back to your original question, sometimes it's not obvious to us if you're an academic or a journalist about how much these details really matter. And in our book, we refer to it as the sort of fine print of the social contract. It's something that's easy for us to gloss over, but actually is really, really important for outcomes like whether you get services or not, or how hassle-free those experiences are.
And so, I mean, what do we know about this? I mean, how big of a deal is it in practice? I mean, obviously, it can be annoying to need to track down 7 different kinds of forms. But then you're talking about stories where people are actually, like, unable to get medical care. And that's like a sort of a world of difference there. How big a deal is this?
There's a huge amount of variance between programs. But if you look at a lot of means-tested programs in particular, sometimes up to 1/3 to 2/3 of people who are eligible don't take up the benefit. And that might be for a variety of reasons, but at least part of it is to do with these administrative burdens. So I think it is true that we think about this as this is hassle, this is red tape, this is a headache, but it actually does have these large effects on take-up rates where there are high degrees of burdens in the process.
One really great example right now are those new Medicaid work requirements, right? Mm-hmm. Now, they seem to be getting beaten back quite a bit. But when you look at the Medicaid work requirements, effectively, it looks like somewhere between 70 and 80% of the people who lost benefits associated with the work requirements were simply because they couldn't figure out how to demonstrate that they were working, mm-hmm. right? That's a pretty big impact.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. And in that case, I mean, you can't read people's minds exactly. But I mean, it seems like that is the intention to an extent of the creation of that, right? That there was not a huge shock that Arkansas didn't see the employment rate skyrocket. Because, I mean, that could be the other thing, right? I mean, you could imagine, okay, if I say, you know, to get Medicaid, you have to work. And so the point of this is going to be a handful of people might lose benefits, but actually tons of people are going to go out and get jobs. And that's not what we saw. And also, when we didn't see it, that didn't, like, change the thinking, right? It's not like the governor's like, uh-oh.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And if you look at the design of the program, there are certain aspects of how Arkansas designed their Medicaid work requirements that sort of tipped you off as to what they were trying to do. So you could only report online, right? And we mm-hmm. know that about a third of Medicaid beneficiaries have very low technological literacy, don't have access to a computer. And so there you're basically cutting off a large amount of those people. There was very little outreach that took place to tell people, hey, mm-hmm. there's this big change happening. You should be aware about it. There was very little help offered by the state to allow people to report. So if they had problems and they needed help to upload their earnings data. So when you look at those details, you sort of think, well, the fix is in here, mm-hmm. right? This is designed to push people out of benefits. And then there was a piece that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine this year that found essentially zero positive impact on labor force participation. It did not move people into the workforce because, as Pam said, pretty much everyone who was affected was already working. It wasn't the work requirements that got them. It was the reporting part of the process. Right. It was the uploading the data online that caused them to lose their health care.
The compliance, right. And, you know, for people who don't know the political context of Arkansas, this is a state that obviously had become much more conservative than average going back several years, but had a Democratic governor, a moderate Democratic governor at the time the Affordable Care Act passed. And so, like a lot of states in that situation, they did the Medicaid expansion. Then he, you know, inevitably was replaced by a Republican. Medicaid is very popular, even in conservative states. So just scrapping expansion was, I think, not politically viable. But, you know, Republicans, they want low levels of public spending, particularly on these kinds of programs. So it becomes a sort of clever tool, right? A political, because saying to people, okay, well, we're going to require work, that is much more politically viable than saying, well, we're going to just toss 20,000 people off their benefits.
Yeah. I mean, so a central point of the book is that these burdens are effectively policy making by other means. It's a mechanism to get policy change without going through the policy process or bypassing programs that are generally popular, and then you do things like that Arkansas did. And there's a range of different examples. Again, you asked, like, well, so how effective is this stuff? Well, effectively, we've substantially reduced access to abortion services by using administrative burdens is another great example. Trap laws, like these laws in states that put onerous requirements on clinics, that put onerous requirements on individuals trying to access abortions, like waiting times, 24 to 48 hour waiting times. All of these things really have reduced, and there's demonstrable evidence of this in places like Texas, have demonstrably reduced access to abortions without actually overturning Roe v. Wade.
Right. So on abortion, the sort of key issue is you can regulate, under at least the current legal precedents, you can regulate the terms under which a clinic can operate.
Right.
Right. And, you know, you would expect to see some regulation in that sphere. It's a, you know, surgical procedure. But by requiring that you have hospital admitting privileges and various other things, you can make it more and more expensive to sort of operate the facility without directly shutting it down.
And it also applies to the women, too, though, trying to access abortion services. So, for example, waiting periods. If mm-hmm. you make people do a 24-hour waiting period and see a physician prior, a physician after, if you have one clinic in the state, if you're poor, you're basically making it impossible for someone to access an abortion. Most women who are unable to access abortions are basically unable to do it because they can't afford it. So you're adding this additional financial cost that effectively rules a lot of people out.
Right, from accessing abortions. A 3-hour drive is hard,
right.
But a 3-hour drive and then another one and then another one.
And a hotel room. And, you know, and so you're looking at people, right, who can't afford to pay $500 for an abortion to begin with, or we really struggle to meet $500, an extra $300 in travel costs, and you've made it impossible. Yeah.
So part of what's fascinating about this as a tool of policymaking is that, one, it's opaque. And second, you can use these other values that people generally buy into as a justification. And so with abortion, the value that people articulate when they're putting these rules in place is that they're protecting the health of the mom, right? And there's this deeply disingenuous aspect to that, but that is the legal argument that states put in front of courts. In the area of welfare, it's often justified in terms of reducing fraud, mm-hmm. right, or increasing labor force participation. And so these administrative burdens are flexible enough that you can attach some unobjectionable policy goal to them, even if your actual policy goal is to minimize abortion or to reduce the size of the welfare rolls or make it harder for people to get access to public health insurance.
Well, and fraud, I mean, is obviously a critical question here because, you know, nobody is going to stand up and defend fraud in politics, obviously. But also, if you think about any kind of complicated system, right, you have you have type 1 errors and type 2 errors. And it's
that's weedy.
Well, it's very challenging to design a real-world set of practices in which everybody you want to help gets help, but nobody who you wouldn't want to get help might get in, right? And so if you focus obsessively on trying to make sure you have an ironclad system in which nobody who doesn't fit some intuitive criteria could possibly slip through, like then tons of people wind up getting left out, in part because documenting everything in your life is just hard, right? I mean, if anyone has ever, been through like a rigorous inquiry, it's like, how do you prove this? Like, if you have sporadic employment, particularly because we're talking about a lot of means-tested welfare programs, this tends to be people who do work sometimes, but probably don't have full-time job year after year after year, and it's hard to do, but then it's hard to stand up and say like, don't care about fraud.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the interesting contradictions we point to is that especially in certain kinds of social welfare programs targeted at poor people, programs disproportionately used by Black Americans, there is this heavy emphasis on preventing fraud and abuse. It's certainly something that the Trump administration has aggressively focused on. And one of the points that we make is if you're thinking about the overall policy goals for social welfare programs, though, sure, we want to make sure that only the people who are supposed to be on these programs are on these programs. But it's just as big of a problem when you have large fractions of people who are supposed to be on the programs and not able to be on them. So when you're looking at fraud and abuse rates of 1% to 2%, and it's not even what we think of as fraud and abuse, right? Because it can frequently be things like, you know, you didn't file the right form. Mm-hmm. Compared to 20 to 50% of people not receiving benefits who are supposed to, our argument is that the balance there is out of whack.
Right. But I mean, that's the question of values, right? It's like,
exactly.
What's the real tragedy? Do you have a poor kid going hungry? Do you have 10 of them to prevent like one guy who maybe didn't need the help getting some extra SNAP benefits?
And some of these are empirical questions, right? We should be able to verify how much people will lose out if you put one set of rules in and how much fraud you're going to prevent. So policymakers can then make the decision, okay, we're willing to tolerate this much loss of coverage for people or reduce benefit access in exchange for better security. But part of our critique is that currently that doesn't happen. There's such a monofocus on the issues of things like fraud that we don't pay attention to the cost that the burdens generate. A great example is the EITC. So the EITC, every so often, this talks about putting more documentation in place. And when you look at the number of audits that the IRS does, a bit over a third of them are directed towards EITC recipients. And their average income is about $20,000. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to get a whole lot of money out of those individuals. And when you look at non-compliance and taxes, about 6% of the loss in revenue from non-compliance and tax payments comes from the EITC, and over half comes from business owners, right? And so a logical framework would say maybe we should be spending more of our audit resources towards where the bigger bang for the buck would be and towards where more of the non-compliance would be, as opposed to relentlessly targeting people who are really not going to provide much revenue to you.
Right. And in the tax cases, basically, right, I mean, the tax evasion that costs the government a lot of money comes from rich people because they have a lot of money. There's a progressive tax structure. So wealthy people dodging taxes costs a lot of money. But they are also, I mean, you talk about burdens. It's harder to go after like wealthy people who have tax attorneys and things like that. They have more clout in Congress as well. And there's been a great series of stories by ProPublica about this. But the IRS has, over the years, at in part the explicit behest of congressional Republicans, put more and more of its efforts into these EITC documentation questions where, I mean, they really do catch people mixing up, but the amounts of money involved are just really small. Like there's only the way EITC works is you can only claim it if you are low income. The benefits are helpful relative to a low income person's income, but it's just not that much money.
And part of the reason why the IRS can target these folks is because they have less of an ability to fight back. So if you get audited as an EITC recipient, you get a letter in the mail, you may not get the letter, you may struggle to understand what it means. You may just decide to give up with the process. And that then gets reported by the IRS as a measure of fraud, right? If you can't deal with the hassles of this process, it's reflected as a fault on your part when it could just be, you know, it's really difficult to deal with the IRS if you're a single mom.
I mean, there is, and it's complicated, but there is evidence, for example, that EITC, for example, is more popular among Republicans than, say, a minimum wage increase. Mm-hmm. There have been examples of them kind of going after it with the argument, basically, that EITC recipients should be treated more like welfare recipients.
Right.
Right, like that kind of argument that, you know, this is a poverty-based program, and so we should make it harder on people.
Yeah. Well, so let's take a break, because then I do want to talk about that sort of moral sort of underpinning here.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot-button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
We were talking earlier about Social Security, right? And this is a program where, you know, the documentation problems are in principle challenging, but the government sort of took it upon itself to solve them. And that's because it seems like there is a fairly robust consensus that it would be sad for old people to not get what is coming to them, right? And you could think the same thing, right? If somebody wrote a story in the newspaper about hundreds of veterans not being able to get care at the VA hospital because of some paperwork shenanigans, everyone would be like, well, we gotta straighten this out. Whereas there's a big question around the EITC, right? It's like when it is conceptualized, at least by Republicans, as, well, this is a form of welfare, then it's good to make it hard to sign up because welfare dependency is a bad thing. There's a lot of questions, you know, suspicion of the undeserving poor, right? And that sort of drives some of the thinking about, do you want to treat these burdens as like problems to be solved or, you know, you're on your own?
It's actually, I mean, I would argue it's a little bit more complicated in some ways. So, for example, Social Security, the truth is that when they were implementing the program and figuring out how to effectively do benefit administration, it was really politically contentious at the time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they actually didn't Congress actually cut their budget, so they had no budget initially to even implement the program. And so really, it was like a real political battle, and you had these progressives in the FDR administration who were just super aggressive about figuring out a way to design and implement the administrative portion of the program to ensure it was politically popular. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely, the program was really contested at the time. So it's a, you know, yeah. So it was a design, it was a progressive design choice to facilitate its political popularity in some respects.
And you think about the contrast between that or Medicare, right, in the 60s and the Affordable Care Act, which was done by Democrats, but it's quite complicated to sign up for those ACA subsidies, right? I mean, that's a change in sort of progressive thinking, or at least the sort of leadership of the party.
Well, yeah, I'll just say briefly about the ACA, right? Like, that is in part, the complexity reflects the desire to include private health insurance, mm-hmm. right? In some ways, it's like a policy feedback effect. Like, if you're going to have this, like, weird mix of public and private insurance combined with federalism. Mm-hmm. So you got your 50 states, and it's really hard to make that administratively simple.
And the EAC is also a good example of sometimes burdens are not intended, right? Mm-hmm. So the website rollout was disastrous because it wasn't because the Obama administration wanted it to fail. But then you look at Republican governors who were tasked with their own part of the implementation process, and they did things like make it much harder for federally funded navigators to help people to sign up. That was an example of the politics coming into play. When the Trump administration came in, slashing the outreach budgets, reducing the amount of funding for navigators, providing some sort of communication where they release videos, for example, telling people about how terrible it was to be on the ACA, right? Those are examples of where there was this really deliberate effort to increase the learning costs and the compliance costs associated with the program.
Right. But, I mean, it does, as you were saying about the inclusion of private insurance, right, it's to an extent baked into the design of the program that part of its launch was this huge advertising campaign that there had to be navigators because it was conceptualized as one of the benefits of this is that, well, you're going to shop for the plans, right? I mean,
which
that was,
nobody wants to do.
Right. But it's like that was an explicit program goal. So there's no default enrollment. Then you decide to reduce the explicit budgetary costs, that it's going to be a sliding scale income type thing. So you need a lot of verification of that. It has to be redone every year because people are supposed to be switching, right? And you can look back on it and say, like, oh, you know, that's crazy. But, it, you know, before Trump started trying to sabotage it. They deliberately created a like fairly high touch kind of program. And, you know, I just have my private health insurance, but it's the same thing. Each year it's like you got to go pick again. And like that's it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah. So you could imagine if we lived in England last year where it was much simpler, right? There were no choices that you had to make. You didn't have to re-enroll and look at 15 different plans every year. You didn't have to carry some sort of insurance card around with you when you went to the pharmacy. Everything was much simpler because it's a universal system. So that's one model. Another model is we have the U.S. system, which is far more complicated, lots of public-private actors, state and federal actors. And then with that system, to make it work, you have to provide people a bunch of health. Help. Health and
help. Help too.
And then there's a third model, which is that you have an incredibly complicated system and you don't help people, and then they're really screwed.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, which is our version. There are ways, to be fair to the ACA, right? Like, there are ways, even with these fairly complicated kind of private public structures, there are ways to simplify, to regulate, to reduce this kind of burdens. And what you did see through the gradual implementation of the ACA across states is some states got really good at figuring out how to help people do it, right? So it's not impossible, but sure, the varying designs of different policies are going to inherently increase or decrease the level.
If you were more optimistic about it, right, you would say, okay, you continue to have elected officials who want this to work well, and then there's an iterative learning process, right, where the government learns about how to give people the help that they need. And by the time you're in the 15th year, it's like it's running really smoothly. But then the additional problem is that you have political disagreement about, like, should we even be helping people do this? Like, do we want this to exist? And you create a program that's much, a lot of what you're talking about is other means, and there's...
It's there's designed like a, to fail.
Right.
Yeah.
Dysfunction by design.
Right. Yeah. Whereas, like, it's hard to undermine the Social Security program once it's up and running, right? There's not a lot you can do administratively. You could pass a new law.
So yeah, no, that it is true. Again, though, like it's really interesting. I mean, if you look at the first 15 years of the program, it was really precarious.
Right.
And actually, the means-tested part of Social Security old age assistance for the first 15 years was a much larger social welfare support for older people than was actually the Social Security program. And so it is interesting to look back because you see all these political battles behind the scenes that were in many ways playing out in the bureaucratic implementation of the program. But there are ways, I mean, one of the concerns around Social Security right now is actually, you know, as the population on Social Security is accelerating pretty rapidly, right, as we're aging and the boomers are aging, the administrative budget for the program has been shrinking. So they've been cutting the administrative budget for the program. A lot of people rely on, there's somewhere around 1,700 or 1,800 field offices spread throughout the country to help people enroll in varying parts of the Social Security program. The wait times at those offices are getting longer. The call times when you call into the program are getting longer. There is some evidence of sort of decay in the administrative structures in Social Security that, you know, they're not— the program is still incredibly popular. It's still relatively easy to use, but it's not immune, basically, from that sort of damage.
You're saying, in particular, it wasn't immune in its
in the first 15 years,
in the
40s
and early 50s, right?
Yeah.
And so that stability is itself like a political outcome.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, one of the most interesting things about the implementation of the program is there was this decision right off to have all these field offices. And this was still at the end of the Depression era. So there was still a ton of unemployment. And people got pretty worried pretty quickly that there'd be a lot of patronage, right? Like your local field office, your local rep is going to want to put like all these unqualified people, like his cousins and political supporters, in those offices, and they wouldn't know what they were doing, right? Which would be really bad for the program. So there was a ton of kind of internal conflict and battles between the people administering the program and implementing it in Congress over ensuring basically that those appointments were non-political, that they were only hiring experts for those offices. And it was a real battle at the beginning.
I mean, because like, this was a different time in the evolution of the state, right? Something I learned recently was back in the 30s, it was like being postmaster general was an important political job. Like I think it was FDR's postmaster general had been the chair of the DNC. It wasn't like a postal administrative job, right? Because that was, it was this like incredible sink house of patronage hiring, and Social Security Administration could have been like that, right? And so the question is like, well, you know, would it be, right? And I mean, it's a burden of its own kind. Another area where it strikes me, aside from social welfare, but where this comes up a lot is voting, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And so earlier we were talking about sort of moral language you sometimes see rolled out. And we give examples in our book where you find politicians essentially saying, you know, people should have to work hard to vote. It shouldn't be easy to vote. It should be like walking through the desert to get water to vote, right? And so you should be willing to vote every year so you don't get kicked off the rolls. You should be willing to register 28 days beforehand if you move. You should be willing to have your ID with you. So that sort of moral language has infused what is generally not a very defensible idea, right? Like, oh, let's make it harder for people to vote is when you talk about it like that, it's hard to really get behind that as a concept. But it's absolutely the case that when you look at voting very much like abortion, there you can see the partisan divide very plainly in state after state where they've taken legislative votes on these issues, about issues like voter ID, about issues like when people can register, whether you can do it on election day or not. Some aspects of this are still left within often the Secretary of State's office, so how often they purge roles and what sort of people get kicked off. Mm-hmm. But very much it is the case that you see voting and registration as a venue where burdens have been put in place. And it's not a new thing, right? So we in our book, we sort of trace the history of voting in America, and we start with the Reconstruction era, and you see many of the same patterns of these administrative barriers being put in place to limit the ability of newly freed slaves to participate in the political process. And it's really only until you get to the late 20th century that both parties sort of sign up to the idea of saying, oh, we should make it easy for people to vote, and turnout is a good thing. And that agreement basically disappeared after 2000.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is like the United States is, I don't know how to put it exactly, but it's a really old political system in a lot of ways, right? And so we had elections from the beginning, but not at all a contemporary vision of universal suffrage, right? You had property qualifications, say nothing of race and gender. So the idea that, like, there should be barriers to voting was really kind of baked in, as opposed to saying, okay, you know, we threw out the dictator yesterday, and now we want a modern system in which all citizens vote. And you always, I mean, I assume every country has some method to ensure that the people voting, you know, really are citizens, or, you know, aren't voting seven times. But so much of that responsibility is put on you here, right? You have to go register. If you move, you have to go register again. It's not your right as someone who factually is an American to go cast a vote. You need to make it happen.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, I also think this is one of the things we talk about in the book, too, is we sort of feel like progressives don't make enough of the issues around administrative burdens in terms of how actually important they are in terms of affecting kind of basic rights that we do or don't have access to. Mm. And voting's obviously a fairly basic right in a democracy. But, you know, for example, we're spending a lot of time now arguing about different Democratic primary candidates. Who's moderate? You know, are they too progressive? Are they too moderate? Are they this or they that? You know, the reality is, like, there's about three states this is going to probably boil down to, right? One of those states in particular, especially Wisconsin, Michigan to some extent, Florida, actually three, have really significant barriers to voting. Mm. Like, I could imagine spending a lot of time and resources just making sure that we have everyone on the rolls, no matter how hard it is, to just get them on the rolls. And that's probably going to have a bigger impact than whether it's Buttigieg or Warren on something.
So how hard is it to vote in Wisconsin? I met you guys in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
I've been living in D.C. for a while. It's actually super easy to vote here. I think because there's no partisan competition at all. But like, what do you do to make it hard to vote?
Well, it used to be a lot easier than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so Wisconsin historically has vied with Minnesota for the highest rates of turnout in the country. Partly because there's a lot of good Scandinavian stock in the people, and they think it's their civic duty, but also because it was one of the first states to adopt Election Day registration. So if you forget to register and you've moved, you can still turn up on Election Day and vote. And the state has also expanded absentee, no excuse voting, which is essentially a form of early voting. So historically, very easy to vote after 2010. Then you see the adoption of a voter ID law. Then you see efforts to reduce the window of time in which you can vote. Certain days got kicked out, so you couldn't vote on Sundays, which was a traditional souls to polls days when black churches got mobilized to come out and vote. Certain groups got targeted more, so if you were a student and you need to vote, then your out-of-state ID will not work. Right, so you have to get the special ID that is good only for voting and for nothing else.
Uh-huh. So your student ID doesn't work. Your regular student ID
that is provided by the state government, right? University of Wisconsin is part of the state. So you have to get the secondary ID, and you have to bring a copy of a transcript or something that shows you're a current student. So you have these additional layers on certain groups that are expected to trend democratic.
I think the right question is not so much how do they make it hard to vote. It's who do they make it hard to vote for? Which group is it hardest to vote for? You know what I mean? Like, it's so clearly targeted at certain groups of people. It's targeted at poor black people, students, and then caught up in some of the friction, though, as well, are actually older adults and people with disabilities. So there's, it's basically designed to prevent particular people from voting.
Right.
Or make it harder.
And I mean, it's not, as you're saying, like, it's on the one hand not new to have barriers to voting in the United States, but there's been an incredible sort of trend in that direction, right? After 2010, I mean, not just in Wisconsin, but that was a year when Republicans did well in a lot of states. And it seems like there's some fairly centralized playbook that they're working off of learning. But it's like it's not a coincidence, right?
No, I think gradually over time, tactics get shifted. So for a while, voter ID was very much the go-to strategy. Now I think there are more efforts to make registration more difficult. Mm-hmm. And as we point out in the book, there's actually more empirical evidence that making registration harder reduces turnout than voter ID has an empirical effect on turnout.
And there's also just, how many polling areas you have open. I mean, we know there's lots of evidence that black people wait in much longer lines to vote. I mean, it's kind of all those layers of burdens.
I mean, the line stuff is shocking to me. I was in Berlin on Federal Election Day in Germany one time, and I, had a chance to observe some people there. And it's amazing how fast and simple it is to vote if you, want it to be, right? I mean, some of this stuff about verifying who people are, it's like there's bound to be some friction there. But, how long the lines are is pretty purely a function of how many spaces do you open up. And lines are, in American urban areas, state governments just make them very long, and that deters people from going.
Yeah, and you see with early voting, the evidence we have about that is that it generally doesn't increase turnout because most of the people who show up are people who would otherwise vote. But there's some evidence that it will bring in more marginal voters if it's expanded more in poorer areas.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's fewer early voting sites in poorer neighborhoods, and they tend to be of lower quality. And so if you actually fully implemented it and had lots of sites that were really accessible for poor people, it might have a much more positive effect on turnout.
If that's what you wanted to do. And then also automatic registration is a trend that Democrats have been pushing, and that's to eliminate a large burden there.
And mail voting. I mean, I think there's a lot of evidence about how effective voting by mail is in states that do it.
How effective is it?
very effective, like Oregon, for example. Right, like you get high participation when you let people just sort of mail in ballots. And it's, you know, that's huge for older people, for people with disabilities, that sort of thing.
Mailing it in is a good thing.
Yeah.
Sure.
but the point about auto enrollment goes beyond voting, right? So we call it automatic registration for elections or auto enrollment with some welfare programs. If you look at the Trump administration, their policies towards SNAP, right, mm-hmm. towards food stamps. Initially, they tried to make it harder to get access to benefits through the Farm Bill. That failed. So then they turned to the rulemaking process and essentially are telling states, we don't want you to use administrative data to help people enroll in the program. We don't want you to basically make use of the information that you already have. We want people to submit extra sets of forms. And so there's a general design principle here that if the state has information that it can use to help you vote or to help you sign up for a program, it should probably use that. And that information may be more reliable and less susceptible to fraud than the form that someone fills out and submits themselves.
Okay, we should take a second break, and I want to get back to this auto-enrollment point.
Support for The Weeds comes from Hydro. So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought.
While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, after I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Okay, so you're talking about administrative data, right? And this is like the government, any given day, has a lot of information about what's going on, right? There's a lot of bureaus, a lot of offices. But typically, oftentimes that information is not used, right? And so if you want something from the government, you need to go cough it up again and say, okay, here's where I live when another office is collecting property taxes on where I live, right? Or you're saying, here's how much money I make when the IRS knows how much money I make, right? And so you're saying, right, if you wanted to, a sound principle for making sure people are enrolled is to use that administrative data.
Right. And we have this debate every April 15th around specifically tax reporting, mm-hmm. when most of the time we are giving the IRS information that they already have, and we're spending hours doing that. We spend something like 7.8 billion hours per year on tax reporting. And so that's sort of the most obvious example, because that mm-hmm. touches all of us. But the IRS and other parts of government has a lot of data that could use to help us get access to other types of programs as well.
There's really great examples, for example, of auto-enrollment in Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin did it at one point under the Doyle administration. Because it's not just about having data on income, but someone on food stamps is likely eligible for Medicaid. So mm-hmm. there's this sort of cross-program enrollment that states can facilitate. And many states do it. It substantially reduces burden. It substantially increases take-up. So, yeah, I mean, they have tons of administrative data that they really can use to reduce burden and increase participation. And
there's some technical challenges to doing this, and there's some privacy issues that are legitimate concerns to talk about. But there's also just the political prohibition from doing this that you're seeing in places like the Trump administration, which is essentially saying you can't use the tools that you have at your disposal to make life easier for citizens.
Yeah, so they've done, I was just researching on this, but they have like a whole set of proposed rules or sometimes completed rules around SNAP, right? Which all of them are about making it harder to sign up. And, you know, one of them, this is like hard to even understand, but it's like into the calculation for how eligible you are has something to do with your utility costs. And there had been a process where states could just sort of take the average and say, okay, here's what it is. And now they want to say, no, everybody needs to do an individualized documentation of their heating bills. And, you know, it's like a, you can imagine, right? It's going to be a terrifying pain. And, you know, ultimately, like, some people get a little bit more and a lot of people get a little bit less. And clearly, like, they just don't want to be spending money on this.
Yeah, one of the biggest aspects to that proposed rule change to SNAP is actually what would happen basically is currently most people don't have to document asset levels to get on SNAP mm-hmm. at this point. They're proposing this rule change, which would make it so effectively now most people would have to do that.
Okay.
And asset requirements, the evidence around it is basically that is administratively one of the toughest things to document, actually.
Because you need to prove you don't secretly have money?
Well, it's complicated.
There's a Mercedes in your garage yeah. that you covered over.
What's complicated about it is, so for example, if I pulled up this book for social workers in Arkansas that detailed how they would figure out someone's asset levels for eligibility. The book itself is about 70 pages long. Mm-hmm. And it starts with what even qualifies as an asset.
Yes.
And then goes right through all the different levels of how you even try to document those assets. And actually, the learning cost is a big part of it, because effectively what the issue is, there are a lot of assets that are precluded from the asset allocation, but most people don't realize that.
But so what is the, like, notional concern here? It's like, I could win the lottery and then quit my job, and then I have a low income, so now I'm signing up for food stamps.
Correct.
But really, I shouldn't be allowed to because I'm so rich.
Correct. So there was the guy in Minnesota, I'm blanking on his name right now, but there was a guy in Minnesota that the Republicans were promoting quite a bit, who was this older gentleman who had, fairly high asset levels. He was, you know, like maybe 70, but a low income level, mm-hmm. right? And so he made a big promotional campaign that he was able to qualify for SNAP in Minnesota because of that. So again, it's like these rare cases.
Right.
Yeah, really
rare
cases.
So how do you
weigh
that case versus, you know, thousands of people who will lose benefits if you design the policy just to exclude that one guy in Minnesota?
And I think part of the point about the one guy in Minnesota, right, is who does that?
Right. No, right. I mean, right. So, like, there's very few people who even make this theoretical
Yeah,
condition.
And then who would do it among the
right.
people who do it?
And then
yeah,
are
right.
they actually doing it? Yeah. And then third, it's like, right, so it's like, who cares, yeah. right? Versus, because you really are, right? Like, how do you demonstrate that you aren't secretly rich? It's challenging, right?
It's both people understanding, because what they hear is, they hear the, oh, I can't have more than $1,500 in assets or $2,500 right. in assets. And they immediately think, oh, but I have a car, or I have this, or I have that.
Right.
Well, some of those things are actually excluded, but people don't know that. Or people know that my car might be excluded, but they think it's worth more than it is because they paid $10,000 with it. But
uh-huh.
really, it's the value, the current value, which might only be $1,000.
Right. So your 7-year-old car
obstacles.
Is not worth
yeah.
what you paid for it.
Yeah.
And, like, I understand that, but also I'm not applying for food stamps.
Right.
Exactly.
So there's the sort of inequality aspect to the process, right, which is that who succeeds in getting through these really onerous processes.
Right.
And it might be people who are super perseverant, like there's just some aspect of their personality that they're super diligent. But there's also good evidence that it's probably going to be correlated to other factors like education and a degree of poverty. And so people who have lower levels of education and who are especially poor might struggle more to get the benefit that they actually need more than the person who succeeds in getting through the administrative
process.
Right,
because you're talking about people who typically not much education, often young, unmarried parents, right? So people with a lot like going on in life, not necessarily like probably never took an accounting class, right? Like maybe don't know what the word assets means exactly, right? In economics terms. And, you know, maybe their language skills, they're not like the best reading subsample of the American population. And you're giving them all these forms and weird stuff. And so then you're supposed to have, you need to have social workers help them navigate it. But if your goal is to get people off, then it's easy to not help.
Yeah, exactly. No, and I mean, I think generally one of the things that we try to point out in the book is it's also important to remember that there are just sort of subpopulations that tend to encounter this stuff more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, yeah, for sure, people with low incomes, people in the low-wage labor market, people with disabilities, parents of kids with disabilities. Like, there's certain groups mm-hmm. that just – this is sort of a constant presence in their life. So some of it might be confusion or, you know, we can't quite figure it out. And some of it just – and when you read people's narratives, Jamila Michener has this really amazing book, Fragmented Democracy, Jamila Michener, Fragmented Democracy. And she's interviewing all these people on Medicaid. And a lot of the narratives, honestly, around some of this are just people are completely overwhelmed, right? You're looking at people who have a lot going on and they're just overwhelmed. So
we know
the ability to manage that.
Studies from behavioral psychology that the experience of poverty is stressful. It reduces your cognitive capacity. It reduces your ability to make good decisions. You're more likely to make a decision that's bad for you in the long run if you're under the stresses of poverty.
Yeah.
And even if you're not. So one of the reasons we ended up writing this book is our older daughter has a disability. And when she was diagnosed at about 18 months old, Medicaid has a waiver program for kids with disabilities. And I've taught health policy my whole career. I knew about the program. Also knew that these programs are really difficult to navigate. So I got on the phone. I got the 50-page booklet in the mail. I got on the phone with a social worker who erroneously sort of told me she didn't think my daughter would qualify. And I just sort of looked at everything, and I was basically like, fuck it. I can't do this.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I do this stuff for a living, and I couldn't fathom getting through the process. So, yeah, it's overwhelming.
Well, I mean, I've got a set of forms that's been sitting on my desk for days and a to-do thing on my phone that's like, deal with the damn forms. And fortunately, my privilege in life is to have one of these like desk jobs where at some point I will, in fact, just like take 45 minutes while I'm supposed to be working and like focus on this other thing. But if you're working at a restaurant, if you're working in a store, right, if you're on your feet, if your work equipment is not like an internet connection, right? It's that much harder to like actually ever find the time when like, when is the office going to be open? Like when is the social worker going to be available?
And how many people have printers in their homes any longer,
right? Right.
Yeah, no, and really, I mean, a lot of these programs require face-to-face contact,
mm-hmm.
right? And the social workers and the administrators are actually typically overwhelmed. If they tell you you have to be here on next Thursday at 2:00, you have to be there next Thursday at 2:00. But if you're working in a low-wage job, you can't just not show up to the low-wage job or you'll get fired. Like, those are the kinds of things that people, that are we know affect enrollment.
And we're, again, I mean, it's not like an unsolvable problem to, like, you could hire more staff, right? So they had more flexibility. The office could stay open later hours, but A, it would cost money, and B, you'd have to want to do it, right? You would have to be plagued by the fear that people who need assistance are not getting it. end. That's often not the case.
Yeah, and a lot of states have, I mean, particularly around one of the things that they did with the passage of the ACA is actually very deliberately try to reduce these kinds of burdens in the Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. So they did things like reduce the number of times, theoretically, in most states that you had to requalify, for example, or eliminate the need for an in-person interview. Yeah, I mean, there's real variance in the degree to which states require that or don't require that.
It's the genius of federalism.
Yeah.
You can imagine then the cumulative effect of these negative experiences, right? So you have to go somewhere at 2 p.m. on Thursday and you can't get the time off work, so you may lose your job. You have to pull together a bunch of documentation that's hard to get. And how that makes people feel about the state, mm-hmm. right? Do you think the state, the government is there to help you, or do you really just experience it through this lens of hassle all of the time? And there's another sort of irony that underlies that fact, which is that we have this conventional wisdom in politics, which is that progressives are the people who are quite comfortable with the use of state power, mm-hmm. and conservatives are really concerned about the state reaching into your life and affecting your individual liberty, when across a series of policy programs we talk about in the book and in healthcare and voting and abortion and welfare policies, you see Republicans having a very high degree of comfort with using administrative power to make people's life more onerous.
So is there any... Is there like good news here? Are there places that have done like exciting new things to make people's lives easier? Are there like hot best practices that should spread around the universe?
So I think there are some examples, but unfortunately it's sort of a polarized issue. So mm-hmm. we talked earlier about auto registration. You see those get adopted in blue states. In some states, you see them get adopted and then vetoed by a Republican governor like Chris Christie in New Jersey. You see some countries, so Estonia is this sort of constant example of this technological paradise.
In public administration.
I took a ferry to Estonia one time with Finnish people, and they were just looking to buy cheap booze. So
there are other things to recommend about Estonia. But Estonia has really invested in technology in their administration. Mm-hmm. And they have this, what they call a once-only principle, which is that once you give information to the government, then the government has it, and you don't have to provide that again.
Yeah, that would be nice.
That would be great, right? I mean, it requires some investment in information technology and government, but it also requires a philosophical approach where you think about how you want to make life easier for citizens.
Mm-hmm. And mostly we don't. I guess.
Mostly we don't.
Or at least not for low-income citizens, right? I mean, this is what you're talking, it's a polarized topic, right? But it's also, it's a particular segment of the population, right, that's really targeted for this.
Yeah, but I do think it's important to keep in mind, even 20 years ago, I mean, it's not entirely, today it's very polarized. There very much have been periods, for example, under George W. Bush, that administration did enormous amount of work actually in reducing administrative burdens in the SNAP program. It's why we mm-hmm. saw this huge increase in take up. Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin had a big impact on reducing administrative burdens in the Medicaid program. You know, I guess the optimistic view is that there are points at which there's consensus around doing this that does go across the political spectrum, although it's fair to say at this point, it's definitely—
This thing with Bush and SNAP, though, actually, it's interesting because I think most liberals, like, don't know that this happened.
No, I know.
But it was a huge turnabout in conservative circles, right? Because this was, like, if— I guess, like, it was a compassionate conservatism thing, and also, like, farmers and Walmart liked having people signed up for SNAP. And so they really changed a lot of stuff and made it a lot easier, and that got a lot more people on the program. And then it became characterized, I think, by a new generation of Republicans as, like, Obama had, like, done something terrible.
Yeah.
But it was actually Bush, and they had just a, like, they changed their thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's completely accurate. We talk about in SNAP, the Bill O'Reilly, you know, using SNAP as this example of abuse of the welfare system where it's really being handed out to these surfers in California mm-hmm. as opposed to the truly needy. Like, so the truly needy has become this subcategory of people who are defined as sort of semi-deserving now in conservative politics, whereas there's an idea that there's a lot of people who aren't that needy who shouldn't be getting these benefits. But yeah, the
this Trump is the famous you people are buying steak with their
SNAP.
Their
lobster
after their lobster before they go to the casino, right? The good life that you're living on SNAP, right? So I think that there has been this turnabout where for a while you did see this bipartisan effort, and partly within the Bush administration, they just had some very good people within the Department of Agriculture. So sometimes I think it's partly an administrative story where they had an undersecretary who really took this as an issue and was successful with it. And partly it's this broader politics story where these political principles decide. And late in the Bush administration, you start to see that happening, especially with Medicaid, that maybe programs have become too generous and too easy to sign on to, and we need to ratchet this back a little bit.
And it's, you know, I feel like one thing that's happening with Trump in this is that his legislative record is, like, fairly meager. So
tax cuts.
Right. So, I mean, so they're trying to show to, like, the conservative universe that, like, that they're doing something. Whereas Bush, I mean, say what you will about him, that was a very eventful, like, 8-year span in the United States Congress. There were multiple tax cuts. There was a big education bill. There was a big farm bill. There was wars, like
a lot going on.
Nobody was ever challenging him. He's like, well, what are you even doing here? Right. Whereas with Trump, like, they passed one tax law.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So this is something that we do talk about generally in the book, which is that this has been the main mechanism by which the Trump administration has been able to enact policy change, certainly with the ACA, right? Like the huge failure to overturn the ACA. So they've used this really effectively. I think it's also important to point out they've used this most effectively in certain agencies where they have competent leadership. So CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Seema Verma, like, she's competent.
Sure.
less so in agencies where there's less competent leadership. But yeah, it's very much the main way in which they've been able to get change.
Yeah, so if you were interested in social policy change, you should be looking at the rulemaking process and you should be looking at the administrative burdens that are being embedded in the big policies like Medicaid and SNAP.
All right. Don Moynihan, Pam Hurd, before I let you guys go, I'd like to close out asking guests, what do you wish I had asked you about here? What did we miss?
I think there's a question about, like, what do you do to solve this problem?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do we solve it?
So there's a bunch of answers here. I think one of these answers is about just training people who work in the public sector to think about costs and benefits that individuals and citizens encounter. Mm-hmm. So we teach some of these students that go work in agencies, and we don't really use this language of administrative burdens terribly much. And so it becomes easier, I think, than for bureaucrats to generate these negative externalities, or at least not be conscious about them in a way that they would be if they had a little bit more of a sense of, boy, that's really going to hurt a certain population of people who won't be able to get through the process.
I think it's partly right about getting people to shift their perspective towards thinking about, okay, what would this actually be like if I was trying to navigate this program, right? Like getting them to perspective shift. Yeah, yeah. And then I think there are, you know, as we talked about some of the tools already, using administrative data, new technologies can be useful along those lines in terms of capturing who would be eligible for programs. But a big part of, one of the things that we talk about, just sort of given the reality of our healthcare system, health insurance system, and social welfare system, we have a lot of private-public mixing, which is inherently complicated. And so sometimes really the best mechanism to reduce burden is just to provide more help to people. So Elizabeth Warren actually, around evictions, has this proposal to basically fully fund public defenders to help people out with evictions.
Right.
That's actually a great example of that kind of help. There's the FAFSA example that Don can talk about.
Yeah, so there's been experiments. FAFSA is the bane of every high school student parent who's getting ready to go to college because it's this famously complicated process to sign up to get federal aid. And there's been some experimental work done to figure out what makes it easier. And in one treatment, if people are just told, hey, you're eligible for this, and here's how you sign up. So it's like reducing learning costs. Uh-huh. We're going to give you the information, and it has no effect. There's another treatment where someone helps you fill out the forms and pull together the documentation. And that has a very big effect. Like it increases enrollment rates in college, actual enrollment rates from about 28% to 36%. That's a big, sizable effect. Part of the takeaway message that we're trying to convey to people who work on the progressive side of the aisle is that this is a form of politics. Mm-hmm. And conservatives have gotten very good at this as a form of politics, and progressives have been left by the wayside. So progressives are really fond of rolling out new programs. Mm-hmm.
Expanding eligibility.
Mm-hmm. Like Kamala Harris got sort of ridiculed on social media because she had a loan forgiveness program where if you started a small business in a low-income area, were there for 3 years, you might get like $20,000 back. And at the same time, we already have this public loan forgiveness program. If you work in the public sector, that's on the book.
Right.
But nobody can get it. Less than 1% of people are eligible to get it, right? And so the much more effective strategy would just be to fix that program.
Right.
And that would improve many more lives than this very targeted, very conditionalized program that's not really going to help a lot of people.
I think the key point on the progressive side is I think there's a tendency to think about this as sort of incremental technocratic change that really misses how large of an impact this stuff has on people. You know, it's not just sort of technocratic, small incremental change. If you're talking about half, in some cases, of people who are eligible for a program not getting benefits, you're not talking about incremental change, right? We're talking about fairly large change.
All right. Pam Hurd, Don Moynihan, thank you so much. The book is Administrative Burden. Everybody should check it out. It's a super weedsy topic, really fascinating stuff. So thanks so much, you guys. Thanks to Malachi Brodus, our engineer, and Jackson Bierfeldt, our producer. And The Weeds will be back on Tuesday.